appeared in the doorway with Gale right behind him.
I was only told they were being confined. Why are they being punished?
For stealing food. We had to restrain them after an altercation over some bread, says the guard. Venia's brows come together as if she's still trying to make sense of it.
No one would tell us anything. We were so hungry. It was just one slice she took.
Octavia begins to sob, muffling the sound in her ragged tunic. I think of how, the first time I survived the arena, Octavia sneaked me a roll under the table because she couldn't bear my hunger. I crawl across to her shaking form. Octavia? I touch her and she flinches. Octavia, it's going to be all right. I'll get you out of here, okay?
This seems extreme, says Plutarch. It's because they took a slice of bread? Asks Gale.
There were repeated infractions leading up to that. They were warned. Still, they took more bread. The guard pauses a moment, as if puzzled by our density.
You can't take bread.
I can't get Octavia to uncover her face, but she lifts it slightly. The shackles on her wrists shift down a few inches, revealing raw sores beneath them. I'm bringing you to my mother. I address the guard. Unchain them. The guard shakes his head.
It's not authorized. Unchain them! Now! I yell.
This breaks his composure. Average citizens don't address him this way.
I have no release orders, and you have no authority to...
Do it on my authority, says Plutarch.
We came to collect these three anyway. They're needed for special defense. I'll take full responsibility.
The guard leaves to make a call. He returns with a set of keys. The preps have been forced into cramped body positions for so long that even once the shackles are removed, they have trouble walking. Gale, Plutarch, and I have to help them. Flavius's foot catches on a metal grate over a circular opening in the floor, and my stomach contracts when I think of why a room would need a drain. The stains of human misery that must have been hosed off these white tiles. In the hospital, I find my mother, the only one I trust to care for them. It takes her a minute to place the three, given their current condition, but already she wears a look of consternation. And I know it's not a result of seeing abused bodies, because they were her daily fare in District 12, but the realization that this sort of thing goes on in 13 as well. My mother was welcomed into the hospital, but she's viewed as more of a nurse than a doctor, despite her lifetime of healing. Still, no one interferes when she guides the trio into an examination room to assess their injuries. I plant myself on a bench in the hall outside the hospital entrance, waiting to hear her verdict. She will be able to read in their bodies the pain inflicted upon them. Gale sits next to me and puts an arm around my shoulder.
She'll fix them up.
I give a nod, wondering if he's thinking about his own brutal flogging back in 12. Plutarch and Fulvia take the bench across from us, but don't offer any comments on the state of my prep team. If they had no knowledge of the mistreatment, then what do they make of this move on President Coyne's part? I decide to help them out.
I guess we've all been put on notice, I say.
What? No. What do you mean? Asks Fulvia.
Punishing my prep team's a warning, I tell her. Not just to me, but to you, too, about who's really in control and what happens if she's not obeyed. If you had any delusions about having power, I'd let them go now. Apparently, a capital pedigree is no protection here. Maybe it's even a liability.
There is no comparison between Plutarch, who masterminded the rebel breakout, and those three beauticians, says Fulvia icily.
I shrug. If you say so, Fulvia. But what would happen if you got on Coyne's bad side? My prep team was kidnapped,
they can at least hope to one day return to the capital. Gale and I can live in the woods. But you? Where would you two run?
Perhaps we're a little more necessary to the war effort than you give us credit for, says Plutarch, unconcerned.
Of course you are. The tributes were necessary to the games, too. Until they weren't, I say. And then we were very disposable, right, Plutarch? That ends the conversation. We wait in silence until my mother finds us. They'll be all right, she reports. No permanent physical injuries.
Good! Splendid, says Plutarch. How soon can they be put to work?
Probably tomorrow, she answers. You'll have to expect some emotional instability after what they've been through. They were particularly ill-prepared, coming from their life in the capital.
Weren't we all? Says Plutarch.
Either because the prep team's incapacitated or I'm too on edge, Plutarch releases me from Mockingjay duties for the rest of the day. Gale and I head down to lunch, where we're served bean and onion stew, a thick slice of bread, and a cup of water. After Venia's story, the bread sticks in my throat, so I slide the rest of it onto Gale's tray. Neither of us speaks much during lunch, but when our bowls are clean, Gale pulls up his sleeve, revealing his schedule.
I've got training next.
I tuck up my sleeve and hold my arm next to his. Me too. I remember that training equals hunting now. My eagerness to escape into the woods, if only for 2 hours, overrides my current concerns. An immersion into greenery and sunlight will surely help me sort out my thoughts. Once off the main corridors, Gale and I race like schoolchildren for the armory, and by the time we arrive, I'm breathless and dizzy. A reminder that I'm not fully recovered. The guards provide our old weapons, as well as knives and a burlap sack that's meant for a game bag. I tolerate having the tracker clamped to my ankle, try to look as if I'm listening when they explain how to use the handheld communicator. The only thing that sticks in my head is that it has a clock, and we must be back inside 13 by the designated hour, or our hunting privileges will be revoked. This is one rule I think I will make an effort to abide. We go outside into the large, fenced-in training area beside the woods. Guards open the well-oiled gates without comment. We would be hard-pressed to get past this fence on our own, 30 feet high and always buzzing with electricity, topped with razor-sharp curls of steel. We move through the woods until the view of the fence has been obscured. In a small clearing, we pause and drop back our heads to bask in the sunlight. I turn in a circle, my arms extended at my sides, revolving slowly so as not to set the world spinning. The lack of rain I saw in 12 has damaged the plants here as well, leaving some with brittle leaves, building a crunchy carpet under our feet. We take off our shoes. Mine don't fit right anyway, since in the spirit of waste not, want not, that rules 13, I was issued a pair someone had outgrown. Apparently one of us walks funny, because they're broken in all wrong. We hunt like in the old days. Silent, needing no words to communicate, because here in the woods we move as two parts of one being. Anticipating each other's movements, watching each other's backs. How long has it been? 8 months? 9? Since we had this freedom? It's not exactly the same, given all that's happened, and the trackers on our ankles, and the fact that I have to rest so often. But it's about as close to happiness as I think I can currently get. The animals here are not nearly suspicious enough. That extra moment it takes to place our unfamiliar scent means their death. In an hour and a half, we've got a mixed dozen, rabbits, squirrels, and turkeys, and decide to knock off to spend the remaining time by a pond that must be fed by an underground spring, since the water's cool and sweet. When Gale offers to clean the game, I don't object.
I stick a few mint leaves on my tongue, close my eyes, and lean back against a rock, soaking in the sounds, letting the scorching afternoon sun burn my skin, almost at peace until Gale's voice interrupts me.
Katniss, why do you care so much about your prep team?
I open my eyes to see if he's joking, but he's frowning down at the rabbit he's skinning.
Why shouldn't I?
Let's see. Because they've spent the last year prettying you up for slaughter? He suggests.
It's more complicated than that. I know them. They're not evil or cruel. They're not even smart. Hurting them, it's like hurting children. They don't see. I mean, they don't know.
I get knotted up in my words.
They don't know what, Katniss, he says. The tributes, who are the actual children involved here, not your trio of freaks, are forced to fight to the death. That you were going into the arena for people's amusement? Was that a big secret in the capital?
No, but they don't view it the way we do, I say.
They're raised on it, and are you actually defending them?
He slips the skin from the rabbit in one quick move. That stings, because in fact, I am, and it's ridiculous. I struggle to find a logical position. I guess I'm defending anyone who's treated like that for taking a slice of bread. Maybe it reminds me too much of what happened to you over a certain turkey. Still, he's right. It does seem strange, my level of concern over the prep team. I should hate them and want to see them strung up. But they're so clueless. And they belong to Cinna, and he was on my side, right?
I'm not looking for a fight, Gale says, but I don't think Coyne was sending you some big message by punishing them for breaking the rules here. She probably thought you'd see it as a favor.
He stuffs the rabbit in the sack and rises.
We better get going if we want to make it back on time.
I ignore his offer of a hand up and get to my feet unsteadily. Fine. Neither of us talks on the way back, but once we're inside the gate, I think of something else. During the quarter quell, Octavia and Flavius had to quit because they couldn't stop crying over me going back in, and Venia could barely say goodbye.
I'll try and keep that in mind as they remake you, says Gale.
Do, I say. We hand the meat over to Greasy Say in the kitchen. She likes District 13 well enough, even though she thinks the cooks are somewhat lacking in imagination. But a woman who came up with a palatable wild dog and rhubarb stew is bound to feel as if her hands are tied here. Exhausted from hunting and my lack of sleep, I go back to my compartment to find it stripped bare, only to remember we've been moved because of Buttercup. I make my way up to the top floor and find compartment E. It looks exactly like compartment 307, except for the window, 2 feet wide, 8 inches high, centered at the top of the outside wall. There's a heavy metal plate that fastens over it, but right now it's propped open, and a certain cat is nowhere to be seen. I stretch out on my bed, and a shaft of afternoon sunlight plays on my face. The next thing I know, my sister is waking me for 1800. Reflection. Prim tells me they've been announcing the assembly since lunch. The entire population, except those needed for essential jobs, is required to attend. We follow directions to the collective, a huge room that easily holds the thousands who show up. You can tell it was built for a larger gathering, and perhaps it held one before the pox epidemic. Prim quietly points out the widespread fallout from that disaster. The pox scars on people's bodies, the slightly disfigured children.
They've suffered a lot here, she says.
After this morning, I'm in no mood to feel sorry for 13. No more than we did in 12, I say. I see my mother lead in a group of mobile patients, still wearing their hospital nightgowns and robes. Finnick stands among them,
looking dazed but gorgeous. In his hands he holds a piece of thin rope, less than a foot in length, too short for even him to fashion into a usable noose. His fingers move rapidly, automatically tying and unraveling various knots as he gazes about. Probably part of his therapy. I cross to him and say, "Hey, Finnick." He doesn't seem to notice, so I nudge him to get his attention. "Finnick, how are you doing?"
"Katniss," he says, gripping my hand.
Relieved to see a familiar face, I think.
"Why are we meeting here?"
I told Coyne I'd be her Mockingjay, but I made her promise to give the other tributes immunity if the rebels won, I tell him. In public, so there are plenty of witnesses.
"Oh, good, because I worry about that with Annie. That she'll say something that could be construed as traitorous without knowing it," says Finnick.
"Annie. Uh-oh, totally forgot her. Don't worry, I took care of it." I give Finnick's hand a squeeze and head straight for the podium at the front of the room. Coyne, who is glancing over her statement, raises her eyebrows at me. "I need you to add Annie Cresta to the immunity list," I tell her. The president frowns slightly.
"Who's that?"
"She's Finnick O'Dare's..."
What? I don't really know what to call her.
"She's Finnick's friend, from District 4, another victor. She was arrested and taken to the Capitol when the arena blew up."
"Oh, the mad girl, that's not really necessary," she says. "We don't make a habit of punishing anyone that frail."
I think of the scene I walked in on this morning, of Octavia huddled against the wall, of how Coyne and I must have vastly different definitions of frailty. But I only say, "No? Then it shouldn't be a problem to add Annie."
"All right," says the president, penciling in Annie's name. "Do you want to be up here with me for the announcement?"
I shake my head.
"I didn't think so. Better hurry and lose yourself in the crowd. I'm about to begin."
I make my way back to Finnick. Words are another thing not wasted in 13. Coyne calls the audience to attention and tells them I have consented to be the Mockingjay, provided the other victors, Peeta, Joanna, Inobaria, and Annie, will be granted full pardon for any damage they do to the rebel cause. In the rumbling of the crowd, I hear the dissent. I suppose no one doubted I would want to be the Mockingjay, so naming a price, one that spares possible enemies, angers them. I stand indifferent to the hostile looks thrown my way. The president allows a few moments of unrest, and then continues in her brisk fashion. Only now the words coming out of her mouth are news to me. "But in return for this unprecedented request, Soldier Everdeen has promised to devote herself to our cause. It follows that any deviance from her mission, in either motive or deed, will be viewed as a break in this agreement. The immunity would be terminated, and the fate of the four victors determined by the law of District 13, as would her own. Thank you." In other words, I step out of line, and we're all dead.
Chapter 5. Another force to contend with. Another power player who has decided to use me as a piece in her games, although things never seem to go according to plan. First, there were the game makers, making me their star and then scrambling to recover from the handful of poisonous berries. Then President Snow, trying to use me to put out the flames of rebellion, only to have my every move become inflammatory. Next, the rebels ensnaring me in the metal claw that lifted me from the arena, designating me to be their Mockingjay, and then having to recover from the shock that I might not want the wings. And now Coyne, with her fistful of precious nukes and her well-oiled machine of a district, finding it's even harder to groom a Mockingjay than to catch one. But she has been the quickest to determine that I have an agenda of my own and am therefore not to be trusted. She has been the first to publicly brand me as a threat.
I run my fingers through the thick layer of bubbles in my tub. Cleaning me up is just a preliminary step to determining my new look. With my acid-damaged hair, sunburned skin, and ugly scars, the prep team has to make me pretty and then damage, burn, and scar me in a more attractive way. Remake her to Beauty Base Zero, Fulvia ordered first thing this morning. We'll work from there. Beauty Base Zero turns out to be what a person would look like if they stepped out of bed looking flawless but natural. It means my nails are perfectly shaped but not polished, my hair soft and shiny but not styled, my skin smooth and clear but not painted. Wax the body hair and erase the dark circles, but don't make any noticeable enhancements. I suppose Cinna gave the same instructions the first day I arrived as a tribute in the capital. Only that was different, since I was a contestant. As a rebel, I thought I'd get to look more like myself, but it seems a televised rebel has her own standards to live up to. After I rinsed the lather from my body, I turned to find Octavia waiting with a towel. She is so altered from the woman I knew in the capital, stripped of the gaudy clothing, the heavy makeup, the dyes and jewelry and knick-knacks she adorned her hair with. I remember how one day she showed up with bright pink tresses, studded with blinking colored lights, shaped like mice. She told me she had several mice at home as pets. The thought repulsed me at the time, since we consider mice vermin, unless cooked. But perhaps Octavia liked them because they were small, soft, and squeaky, like her. As she pats me dry, I try to become acquainted with the District 13 Octavia. Her real hair turns out to be a nice auburn. Her face is ordinary, but has an undeniable sweetness. She's younger than I thought, maybe early 20s. Devoid of the 3-inch decorative nails, her fingers appear almost stubby, and they can't stop trembling. I want to tell her it's okay, that I'll see that Coy never hurts her again. But the multicolored bruises flowering under her green skin only remind me how impotent I am. Flavius, too, appears washed out without his purple lipstick and bright clothes. He's managed to get his orange ringlets back in some sort of order, though. It's Venia who's the least changed. Her aqua hair lies flat instead of in spikes, and you can see the roots growing in gray. However, the tattoos were always her most striking characteristic, and they're as golden and shocking as ever. She comes and takes the towel from Octavia's hands.
Katniss is not going to hurt us, she says quietly but firmly to Octavia. Katniss did not even know we were here. Things will be better now.
Octavia gives a slight nod, but doesn't dare look me in the eye. It's no simple job getting me back to Beauty Base Zero. Even with the elaborate arsenal of products, tools, and gadgets Plutarch had the foresight to bring from the capital, my preps do pretty well until they try to address the spot on my arm where Joanna dug out the tracker. None of the medical team was focusing on looks when they patched up the gaping hole. Now I have a lumpy, jagged scar that ripples out over a space the size of an apple. Usually, my sleeve covers it, but the way Cinna's Mockingjay costume is designed, the sleeves stop just above the elbow. It's such a concern that Fulvia and Plutarch are called in to discuss it. I swear, the sight of it triggers Fulvia's gag reflex. For someone who works with a game maker, she's awfully sensitive. But I guess she's used to seeing unpleasant things only on a screen. Everyone knows I have a scar here, I say sullenly.
Knowing it and seeing it are two different things, says Fulvia. It's positively repulsive. Plutarch and I will think of something during lunch.
It'll be fine, says Plutarch with a dismissive wave of his hand. Maybe an armband or something.
Disgusted, I get dressed so I can head to the dining hall. My prep team huddles in a little group by the door. Are they bringing your food here? I ask.
No, says Venia. We're supposed to go to a dining hall.
I sigh inwardly as I imagine walking into the dining hall trailed by these three. But people always stare at me anyway. This will be more of the same. I'll show you where it is, I say. Come on. The covert glances and quiet murmurs I usually evoke are nothing compared to the reaction brought on by the sight of my bizarre-looking prep team. The gaping mouths, the finger-pointing, the exclamations. Just ignore them, I tell my prep team. Eyes downcast, with mechanical movements, they follow me through the line, accepting bowls of grayish fish and okra stew and cups of water. We take seats at my table, beside a group from the seam. They show a little more restraint than the people from 13 do, although it may just be from embarrassment. Levy, who was my neighbor back in 12, gives a cautious hello to the preps, and Gail's mother, Hazel, who must know about their imprisonment, holds up a spoonful of the stew.
Don't worry, she says. Tastes better than it looks.
But it's Posy, Gail's 5-year-old sister, who helps the most. She scoots along the bench to Octavia and touches her skin with a tentative finger.
You're green. Are you sick?
It's a fashion thing, Posy, like wearing lipstick, I say.
It's meant to be pretty,
whispers Octavia, and I can see the tears threatening to spill over her lashes. Posy considers this and says matter-of-factly,
I think you'd be pretty in any color.
The tiniest of smiles forms on Octavia's lips.
Thank you.
If you really want to impress Posy, you'll have to dye yourself bright pink, says Gail, thumping his tray down beside me. That's her favorite color.
Posy giggles and slides back down to her mother. Gail nods at Flavius's bowl.
I wouldn't let that get cold. It doesn't improve the consistency.
Everyone gets down to eating. The stew doesn't taste bad, but there's a certain sliminess that's hard to get around. Like you have to swallow every bite 3 times before it really goes down. Gail, who's not usually much of a talker during meals, makes an effort to keep the conversation going, asking about the makeover. I know it's his attempt at smoothing things over. We argued last night, after he suggested I'd left Coin no choice but to counter my demand for the Victor's safety with one of her own.
Katniss, she's running this district. She can't do it if it seems like she's caving into your will.
You mean she can't stand any dissent, even if it's fair? I'd countered.
I mean you put her in a bad position, making her give PETA and the others immunity when we don't even know what sort of damage they might cause, said Gail.
So I should have just gone with the program and let the other tributes take their chances? Not that it matters, because that's what we're all doing anyway. That was when I'd slammed the door in his face. I hadn't sat with him at breakfast, and when Plutarch had sent him down to training this morning, I'd let him go without a word. I know he only spoke out of concern for me, but I really need him to be on my side, not Coin's. How can he not know that? After lunch, Gail and I are scheduled to go down to Special Defense to meet Beatty. As we ride the elevator, Gail finally says,
You're still angry.
And you're still not sorry, I reply. I still stand by what I said. Do you want me to lie about it? He asks. No, I want you to rethink it and come up with the right opinion, I tell him. But this just makes him laugh. I have to let it go. There's no point in trying to dictate what Gail thinks, which, if I'm honest, is one reason I trust him. The special defense level is situated almost as far down as the dungeons where we found the prep team. It's a beehive of rooms full of computers, labs, research equipment, and testing ranges. When we ask for Beatty, we're directed through the maze until we reach an enormous plate glass window. Inside is the first beautiful thing I've seen in the District 13 compound. A replication of a meadow filled with real trees and flowering plants, and alive with hummingbirds. Beatty sits motionless in a wheelchair at the center of the meadow, watching a spring green bird hover in midair as it sips nectar from a large orange blossom. His eyes follow the bird as it darts away, and he catches sight of us. He gives a friendly wave for us to join him inside. The air's cool and breathable, not humid and muggy as I'd expected. From all sides comes the whir of tiny wings, which I used to confuse with the sound of insects in our woods at home. I have to wonder what sort of fluke allowed such a pleasing place to be built here. Beatty still has the pallor of someone in convalescence, but behind those ill-fitting glasses his eyes are alight with excitement. Aren't they magnificent? 13 has been studying their aerodynamics here for years, forward and backward flight, and speeds up to 60 miles per hour. If only I could build you wings like these, Katniss.
Doubt I could manage them, Beatty, I laugh.
Here 1 second, gone the next. Can you bring a hummingbird down with an arrow? He asks.
I've never tried. Not much meat on them, I answer.
No, and you're not one to kill for sport, he says. I bet they'd be hard to shoot, though.
You could snare them, maybe, Gale says.
His face takes on that distant look it wears when he's working something out.
Take a net with a very fine mesh, enclose an area, and leave a mouth of a couple square feet. Bait the inside with nectar flower. While they're feeding, snap the mouth shut. They'd fly away from the noise, but only encounter the far side of the net.
Would that work? Asks Beatty.
I don't know, just an idea, says Gale. They might outsmart it.
They might. But you're playing on their natural instincts to flee danger, thinking like your prey. That's where you find their vulnerabilities, says Beatty.
I remember something I don't like to think about. In preparation for the quell, I saw a tape where Beatty, who was still a boy, connected two wires that electrocuted a pack of kids who were hunting him. The convulsing bodies, the grotesque expressions. Beatty, in the moments that led up to his victory in those long-ago Hunger Games, watched the others die. Not his fault, only self-defense. We were all acting only in self-defense. Suddenly, I want to leave the hummingbird room before somebody starts setting up a snare. Beatty, Plutarch said you had something for me.
Right, I do. Your new bow.
He presses a hand control on the arm of the chair and wheels out of the room. As we follow him through the twists and turns of special defense, he explains about the chair.
I can walk a little now. It's just that I tire so quickly, it's easier for me to get around this way.
How's Finnick doing?
He's having concentration problems, I answer. I don't want to say he had a complete mental meltdown.
Concentration problems, eh? Beatty smiles grimly. If you knew what Finnick's been through the last few years, you'd know how remarkable it is he's still with us at all.
Tell him I've been working on a new trident for him, though, will you? Something to distract him a little.
Distraction seems to be the last thing Finnick needs, but I promise to pass on the message. Four soldiers guard the entrance to the hall marked Special Weaponry. Checking the schedules printed on our forearms is just a preliminary step. We also have fingerprint, retinal, and DNA scans, and have to step through special metal detectors. Beatty has to leave his wheelchair outside, although they provide him with another one once we're through security. I find the whole thing bizarre, because I can't imagine anyone raised in District 13 being a threat the government would have to guard against. Have these precautions been put in place because of the recent influx of immigrants? At the door of the armory, we encounter a second round of identification checks, as if my DNA might have changed in the time it took to walk 20 yards down the hallway, and are finally allowed to enter the weapons collection. I have to admit, the arsenal takes my breath away. row upon row of firearms, launchers, explosives, armored vehicles. Of course, the airborne division is housed separately, Beatty tells us. Of course, I say, as if this would be self-evident. I don't know where a simple bow and arrow could possibly find a place in all this high-tech equipment, but then we come upon a wall of deadly archery weapons. I've played with a lot of the Capitol's weapons in training, but none designed for military combat. I focus my attention on a lethal-looking bow so loaded down with scopes and gadgetry, I'm certain I can't even lift it, let alone shoot it. Gale, maybe you'd like to try out a few of these, says Beatty.
Seriously? Gale asks.
You'll be issued a gun eventually for battle, of course, but if you appear as part of Katniss's team in the propos, one of these would look a little showier. I thought you might like to find one that suits you, says Beatty.
Yeah, I would.
Gale's hands close around the very bow that caught my attention a moment ago, and he hefts it onto his shoulder. He points it around the room, peering through the scope. That doesn't seem very fair to the deer, I say.
Wouldn't be using it on deer, would I?
He answers. I'll be right back, says Beatty. He presses a code into a panel, and a small doorway opens. I watch until he's disappeared and the door's shut. So, it'd be easy for you, using that on people? I ask.
I didn't say that.
Gale drops the bow to his side. But if I'd had a weapon that could have stopped what I saw happen in 12, if I'd had a weapon that could have kept you out of the arena, I'd have used it. Me too, I admit. But I don't know what to tell him about the aftermath of killing a person, about how they never leave you. Beatty wheels back in with a tall black rectangular case awkwardly positioned between his footrest and his shoulder. He comes to a halt and tilts it toward me.
For you.
I set the case flat on the floor and undo the latches along one side. The top opens on silent hinges. Inside the case, on a bed of crushed maroon velvet, lies a stunning black bow.
Oh!
I whisper in admiration. I lift it carefully into the air to admire the exquisite balance, the elegant design, and the curve of the limbs that somehow suggests the wings of a bird extended in flight. There's something else. I have to hold very still to make sure I'm not imagining it. No. The bow is alive in my hands. I press it against my cheek and feel the slight hum travel through the bones of my face. What's it doing? I ask.
Saying hello, explains Beatty with a grin.
It heard your voice. It recognizes my voice? I ask.
Only your voice, he tells me. You see, they wanted me to design a bow based purely on looks, as part of your costume, you know. But I kept thinking, what a waste. I mean, what if you do need it sometime, as more than a fashion accessory? So I left the outside simple and left the inside to my imagination. Best explained in practice, though. Want to try those out?
We do. A target range has already been prepared for us. The arrows that Beatty designed are no less remarkable than the bow. Between the two, I can shoot with accuracy over 100 yards. The variety of arrows, razor sharp, incendiary, explosive, turn the bow into a multi-purpose weapon. Each one is recognizable by a distinctive colored shaft. I have the option of voice override at any time, but have no idea why I would use it. To deactivate the bow's special properties, I need only tell it, good night. Then it goes to sleep until the sound of my voice wakes it again. I'm in good spirits by the time I get back to the prep team, leaving Beatty and Gale behind. I sit patiently through the rest of the paint job and don my costume, which now includes a bloody bandage over the scar on my arm to indicate I've been in recent combat.
Venia affixes my Mockingjay pin over my heart. I take up my bow and the sheath of normal arrows that Beatty made, knowing they would never let me walk around with the loaded ones. Then we're out on the sound stage, where I seem to stand for hours while they adjust makeup and lighting and smoke levels. Eventually, the commands coming via intercom from the invisible people in the mysterious glassed-in booth become fewer and fewer. Fulvia and Plutarch spend more time studying and less time adjusting me. Finally, there's quiet on the set. For a full 5 minutes, I am simply considered. Then Plutarch says, "I think that does it." I'm beckoned over to a monitor. They play back the last few minutes of taping, and I watch the woman on the screen. Her body seems larger in stature, more imposing than mine. Her face smudged but sexy. Her brows black and drawn in an angle of defiance. Wisps of smoke, suggesting she has either just been extinguished or is about to burst into flames, rise from her clothes. I do not know who this person is. Finnick, who's been wandering around the set for a few hours, comes up behind me and says with a hint of his old humor,
"They'll either want to kill you, kiss you, or be you."
Everyone's so excited, so pleased with their work. It's nearly time to break for dinner, but they insist we continue. Tomorrow we'll focus on speeches and interviews and have me pretend to be in rebel battles. Today they want just one slogan, just one line that they can work into a short propo to show to coin. "People of Panem, we fight, we dare, we end our hunger for justice." That's the line. I can tell by the way they present it that they've spent months, maybe years, working it out and are really proud of it. It seems like a mouthful to me, though, and stiff. I can't actually imagine saying it in real life unless I was using a capital accent and making fun of it. Like when Gail and I used to imitate Effie Trinket's, "May the odds be ever in your favor." But Fulvia's right in my face, describing a battle I've just been in, and how my comrades in arms are all lying dead around me, and how, to rally the living, I must turn to the camera and shout out the line. I'm hustled back to my place, and the smoke machine kicks in. Someone calls for quiet. The cameras start rolling, and I hear action. So I hold my bow over my head and yell with all the anger I can muster, "People of Panem, we fight, we dare, we end our hunger for justice." There's dead silence on the set. It goes on and on. Finally, the intercom crackles and Haymitch's acerbic laugh fills the studio. He contains himself just long enough to say, "And that, my friends, is how a revolution dies."
Chapter 6. The shock of hearing Haymitch's voice yesterday, of learning that he was not only functional but had some measure of control over my life again, enraged me. I left the studio directly and refused to acknowledge his comments from the booth today. Even so, I knew immediately he was right about my performance. It took the whole of this morning for him to convince the others of my limitations. That I can't pull it off. I can't stand in a television studio wearing a costume and makeup in a cloud of fake smoke and rally the districts to victory. It's amazing, really, how long I have survived the cameras. The credit for that, of course, goes to PETA. Alone, I can't be the Mockingjay. We gather around the huge table in command, Coin and her people, Plutarch, Fulvia, and my prep team, a group from 12 that includes Haymitch and Gale, but also a few others I can't explain, like Levy and Greasy Say. At the last minute, Finnick wheels Beatty in, accompanied by Dalton, the cattle expert from 10. I suppose that Coin has assembled this strange assortment of people as witnesses to my failure. However, it's Haymitch who welcomes everyone, and by his words,
I understand that they have come at his personal invitation. This is the first time we've been in a room together since I clawed him. I avoid looking at him directly, but I catch a glimpse of his reflection in one of the shiny control consoles along the wall. He looks slightly yellow and has lost a lot of weight, giving him a shrunken appearance. For a second, I'm afraid he's dying. I have to remind myself that I don't care. The first thing Haymitch does is to show the footage we've just shot. I seem to have reached some new low under Plutarch and Fulvia's guidance. Both my voice and body have a jerky, disjointed quality, like a puppet being manipulated by unseen forces.
"All right," Haymitch says when it's over. "Would anyone like to argue that this is of use to us in winning the war?"
No one does.
That saves time. So let's all be quiet for a minute. I want everyone to think of one incident where Katniss Everdeen genuinely moved you. Not where you were jealous of her hairstyle, or her dress went up in flames, or she made a halfway decent shot with an arrow. Not where Peeta was making you like her. I want to hear one moment where she made you feel something real.
Quiet stretches out, and I'm beginning to think it will never end. When Levy speaks up.
"When she volunteered to take Prim's place at the reaping, because I'm sure she thought she was going to die."
"Good. Excellent example," says Haymitch.
He takes a purple marker and writes on a notepad.
"Volunteered for sister at reaping."
Haymitch looks around the table.
"Somebody else?"
I'm surprised that the next speaker is Boggs, who I think of as a muscular robot that does Coin's bidding.
"When she sang the song, while the little girl died."
Somewhere in my head, an image surfaces of Boggs with a young boy perched up on his hip. In the dining hall, I think, maybe he's not a robot after all.
"Who didn't get choked up at that, right?"
says Haymitch, writing it down.
"I cried when she drugged Peeta so she could go get him medicine, and when she kissed him goodbye,"
blurts out Octavia. Then she covers her mouth, like she's sure this was a bad mistake. But Haymitch only nods.
"Oh yeah, drugs Peeta to save his life. Very nice."
The moments begin to come thick and fast, and in no particular order, when I took Ruan as an ally, extended my hand to Chaff on interview night, tried to carry Mags, and again when I held out those berries that meant different things to different people. Love for Peeta, refusal to give in under impossible odds, defiance of the capital's inhumanity. Haymitch holds up the notepad.
"So, the question is, what do all of these have in common?"
"They were Katniss's," says Gale quietly. "No one told her what to do or say."
"Unscripted, yes," says Beatty. He reaches over and pats my hand. "So we should just leave you alone, right?"
People laugh. I even smile a little.
"Well, that's all very nice, but not very helpful,"
says Fulvia peevishly.
"Unfortunately, her opportunities for being wonderful are rather limited here in 13, so unless you're suggesting we toss her into the middle of combat..."
"That's exactly what I'm suggesting," says Haymitch. "Put her out in the field and just keep the cameras rolling."
"But people think she's pregnant," Gale points out.
"We'll spread the word that she lost the baby from the electrical shock in the arena," Plutarch replies. "Very sad. Very unfortunate."
The idea of sending me into combat is controversial, but Haymitch has a pretty tight case. If I perform well only in real-life circumstances, then into them I should go.
"Every time we coach her or give her lines, the best we can hope for is okay. It has to come from her. That's what people are responding to."
"Even if we're careful, we can't guarantee her safety," says Boggs. "She'll be a target for every..."
"I want to go," I break in. "I'm no help to the rebels here."
And if you're killed? Asks Coin. Make sure you get some footage. You can use that anyway, I answer.
Fine, says Coin, but let's take it one step at a time. Find the least dangerous situation that can evoke some spontaneity in you.
She walks around command, studying the illuminated district maps that show the ongoing troop positions in the war.
Take her into 8 this afternoon. There was heavy bombing this morning, but the raid seems to have run its course. I want her armed with a squad of bodyguards. Camera crew on the ground. Hamish, you'll be airborne and in contact with her. Let's see what happens there. Does anyone have any other comments?
Wash her face, says Dalton. Everyone turns to him. She's still a girl, and you made her look 35.
Feels wrong, like something the Capitol would do. As Coin adjourns the meeting, Hamish asks her if he can speak to me privately. The others leave, except for Gale, who lingers uncertainly by my side.
What are you worried about? Hamish asks him. I'm the one who needs the bodyguard.
It's okay, I tell Gale, and he goes. Then there's just the hum of the instruments, the purr of the ventilation system. Hamish takes the seat across from me.
We're going to have to work together again, so go ahead, just say it.
I think of the snarling, cruel exchange back on the hovercraft, the bitterness that followed, but all I say is, I can't believe you didn't rescue Peter.
I know,
he replies. There's a sense of incompleteness, and not because he hasn't apologized, but because we were a team. We had a deal to keep Peter safe. A drunken, unrealistic deal made in the dark of night, but a deal just the same. And in my heart of hearts, I know we both failed.
Now you say it, I tell him.
I can't believe you let him out of your sight that night, says Hamish.
I nod. That's it. I play it over and over in my head. What I could have done to keep him by my side without breaking the alliance, but nothing comes to me.
You didn't have a choice. And even if I could have made Plutarch stay and rescue him that night, the whole hovercraft would have gone down. We barely got out as it was.
I finally meet Hamish's eyes. Seam eyes, gray and deep and ringed with the circles of sleepless nights.
He's not dead yet, Katniss.
We're still in the game. I try to say this with optimism, but my voice cracks.
Still in, and I'm still your mentor.
Hamish points his marker at me.
When you're on the ground, remember, I'm airborne. I'll have the better view, so do what I tell you.
We'll see, I answer. I return to the remake room and watch the streaks of makeup disappear down the drain as I scrub my face clean. The person in the mirror looks ragged, with her uneven skin and tired eyes, but she looks like me. I rip the armband off, revealing the ugly scar from the tracker. There. That looks like me, too. Since I'll be in a combat zone, Beatty helps me with armor Cinna designed. A helmet of some interwoven metal that fits close to my head. The material's supple, like fabric, and can be drawn back like a hood in case I don't want it up full time. A vest to reinforce the protection over my vital organs. A small white earpiece that attaches to my collar by a wire. Beatty secures a mask to my belt that I don't have to wear unless there's a gas attack.
If you see anyone dropping for reasons you can't explain, put it on immediately, he says.
Finally, he straps a sheath divided into 3 cylinders of arrows to my back.
Just remember, right side, fire, left side, explosive, center, regular. You shouldn't need them, but better safe than sorry.
Boggs shows up to escort me down to the airborne division. Just as the elevator arrives, Finnick appears in a state of agitation.
Katniss, they won't let me go. I told them I'm fine, but they won't even let me ride in the hovercraft.
I take in Finnick, his bare legs showing between his hospital gown and slippers, his tangle of hair, the half-knotted rope twisted around his fingers, the wild look in his eyes, and know any plea on my part will be useless.
Even I don't think it's a good idea to bring him. So I smack my hand on my forehead and say, "Oh, I forgot! It's this stupid concussion! I was supposed to tell you to report to Beatty in special weaponry. He's designed a new trident for you." At the word trident, it's as if the old Finnick surfaces.
"Really? What's it do?"
"I don't know, but if it's anything like my bow and arrows, you're going to love it," I say. "You'll need to train with it, though."
"Right, of course. I guess I better get down there," he says.
"Finnick," I say, "maybe some pants?" He looks down at his legs as if noticing his outfit for the first time. Then he whips off his hospital gown, leaving him in just his underwear.
"Why? Do you find this..."
He strikes a ridiculously provocative pose.
"Distracting?"
I can't help laughing because it's funny, and it's extra funny because it makes Boggs look so uncomfortable. And I'm happy because Finnick actually sounds like the guy I met at the Quarter Quell.
"I'm only human, O'Dare."
I get in before the elevator doors close. "Sorry," I say to Boggs.
"Don't be. I thought you handled that well," he says. "Better than me having to arrest him, anyway."
"Yeah," I say. I sneak a sidelong glance at him. He's probably in his mid-40s, with close-cropped gray hair and blue eyes. Incredible posture. He's spoken out twice today, in ways that make me think he would rather be friends than enemies. Maybe I should give him a chance, but he just seems so in step with Coin. There's a series of loud clicks. The elevator comes to a slight pause and then begins to move laterally to the left.
"It goes sideways?" I ask. "Yes, there's a whole network of elevator paths under 13, he answers. "This one lies just above the transport spoke to the 5th airlift platform. It's taking us to the hangar."
The hangar? The dungeons? Special defense? Somewhere food is grown, power generated, air and water purified. 13 is even larger than I thought.
"Can't take credit for much of it," says Boggs. "We basically inherited the place. It's been all we can do to keep it running."
The clicks resume. We drop down again briefly, just a couple of levels, and the doors open on the hangar.
"Oh!"
I let out involuntarily at the sight of the fleet, row after row of different kinds of hovercraft.
"Did you inherit these, too?"
"Some we manufactured, some were part of the Capital's Air Force. They've been updated, of course," says Boggs. I feel that twinge of hatred against 13 again. "So you had all this, and you left the rest of the districts defenseless against the Capital?"
"It's not that simple," he shoots back. "We were in no position to launch a counterattack until recently. We could barely stay alive. After we'd overthrown and executed the Capital's people, only a handful of us even knew how to pilot. We could have nuked them with missiles, yes, but there's always the larger question. If we engage in that type of war with the Capital, would there be any human life left?"
"That sounds like what PETA said, and you all called him a traitor," I counter.
"Because he called for a ceasefire," says Boggs. "You'll notice neither side has launched nuclear weapons. We're working it out the old-fashioned way. Over here, Soldier Everdeen?"
He indicates one of the smaller hovercraft. I mount the stairs and find it packed with the television crew and equipment. Everyone else is dressed in 13's dark gray military jumpsuits. Even Haymitch, although he seems unhappy about the snugness of his collar. Fulvia Cardew hustles over and makes a sound of frustration when she sees my clean face.
"All that work down the drain. I'm not blaming you, Katniss. It's just that very few people are born with camera-ready faces.
Like him."
She snags Gale, who's in a conversation with Plutarch, and spins him toward us.
"Isn't he handsome?"
Gale does look striking in the uniform, I guess. But the question just embarrasses us both, given our history. I'm trying to think of a witty comeback when Boggs says brusquely,
"Well, don't expect us to be too impressed. We just saw Finnick O'Dare in his underwear."
I decide to go ahead and like Boggs. There's a warning of the upcoming takeoff, and I strap myself into a seat next to Gale, facing off with Haymitch and Plutarch. We glide through a maze of tunnels that opens out onto a platform. Some sort of elevator device lifts the craft slowly up through the levels. All at once, we're outside in a large field surrounded by woods. Then we rise off the platform and become wrapped in clouds. Now that the flurry of activity leading up to this mission is over, I realize I have no idea what I'm facing on this trip to District 8. In fact, I know very little about the actual state of the war, or what it would take to win it, or what would happen if we did. Plutarch tries to lay it out in simple terms for me. First of all, every district is currently at war with the capital except two, which has always had a favored relationship with our enemies despite its participation in the Hunger Games. They get more food and better living conditions. After the Dark Days and the supposed destruction of 13, District 2 became the capital's new center of defense, although it's publicly presented as the home of the nation's stone quarries, in the same way that 13 was known for graphite mining. District 2 not only manufactures weaponry, it trains and even supplies peacekeepers. "You mean some of the peacekeepers are born in 2?" I ask. "I thought they all came from the capital." Plutarch nods. "That's what you're supposed to think. And some do come from the capital, but its population could never sustain a force that size. Then there's the problem of recruiting capital-raised citizens for a dull life of deprivation in the districts. A 20-year commitment to the peacekeepers, no marriage, no children allowed. Some buy into it for the honor of the thing, others take it on as an alternative to punishment. For instance, join the peacekeepers and your debts are forgiven. Many people are swamped in debt in the capital, but not all of them are fit for military duty. So District 2 is where we turn for additional troops. It's a way for their people to escape poverty and a life in the quarries. They're raised with a warrior mindset. You've seen how eager their children are to volunteer to be tributes. Cato and Clove, Brutus and Inabaria. I've seen their eagerness and their bloodlust, too. But all the other districts are on our side?" I ask. "Yes. Our goal is to take over the districts one by one, ending with District 2, thus cutting off the capital's supply chain. Then, once it's weakened, we invade the capital itself," says Plutarch. "That will be a whole other type of challenge. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it." "If we win, who would be in charge of the government?" Gale asks. "Everyone," Plutarch tells him. "We're going to form a republic where the people of each district and the capital can elect their own representatives to be their voice in a centralized government." "Don't look so suspicious. It's worked before." "In books," Haymitch mutters. "In history books," says Plutarch. "And if our ancestors could do it, then we can too." "Frankly, our ancestors don't seem much to brag about. I mean, look at the state they left us in, with the wars and the broken planet. Clearly, they didn't care about what would happen to the people who came after them. But this republic idea sounds like an improvement over our current government." "And if we lose?" I ask.
"If we lose?"
Plutarch looks out at the clouds, and an ironic smile twists his lips. "Then I would expect next year's Hunger Games to be quite unforgettable." "That reminds me." He takes a vial from his vest, shakes a few deep violet pills into his hand, and holds them out to us. "We named them Nightlock in your honor, Katniss. The rebels can't afford for any of us to be captured now, but I promise it will be completely painless." I take hold of a capsule, unsure of where to put it. Plutarch taps a spot on my shoulder at the front of my left sleeve. I examine it and find a tiny pocket that both secures and conceals the pill. Even if my hands were tied, I could lean my head forward and bite it free.
Cinna, it seems, has thought of everything.
Chapter 7. The hovercraft makes a quick spiral descent onto a wide road on the outskirts of 8. Almost immediately, the door opens, the stairs slide into place, and we're spit out onto the asphalt. The moment the last person disembarks, the equipment retracts. Then the craft lifts off and vanishes. I'm left with a bodyguard made up of Gale, Boggs, and two other soldiers. The TV crew consists of a pair of burly Capitol cameramen with heavy mobile cameras encasing their bodies like insect shells. A woman director named Cressida, who has a shaved head tattooed with green vines, and her assistant, Misala, a slim young man with several sets of earrings. On careful observation, I see his tongue has been pierced too, and he wears a stud with a silver ball the size of a marble. Boggs hustles us off the road toward a row of warehouses as a second hovercraft comes in for a landing. This one brings crates of medical supplies and a crew of 6 medics. I can tell by their distinctive white outfits. We all follow Boggs down an alley that runs between 2 dull gray warehouses. Only the occasional access ladder to the roof interrupts the scarred metal walls. When we emerge onto the street, it's like we've entered another world. The wounded from this morning's bombing are being brought in. On homemade stretchers, in wheelbarrows, on carts slung across shoulders and clenched tight in arms, bleeding, limbless, unconscious, propelled by desperate people to a warehouse with a sloppily painted H above the doorway. It's a scene from my old kitchen where my mother treated the dying, multiplied by 10, by 50, by 100. I had expected bombed-out buildings, and instead find myself confronted with broken human bodies. This is where they plan on filming me? I turn to Boggs. This won't work, I say. I won't be good here. He must see the panic in my eyes, because he stops a moment and places his hands on my shoulders. You will. Just let them see you. That will do more for them than any doctor in the world could. A woman directing the incoming patients catches sight of us, does a sort of double take, and then strides over. Her dark brown eyes are puffy with fatigue, and she smells of metal and sweat. A bandage around her throat needed changing about 3 days ago. The strap of the automatic weapon slung across her back digs into her neck, and she shifts her shoulder to reposition it. With a jerk of her thumb, she orders the medics into the warehouse. They comply without question. "This is Commander Paler of 8," says Boggs. "Commander, Soldier Katniss Everdeen." She looks young to be a commander, early 30s, but there's an authoritative tone to her voice that makes you feel her appointment wasn't arbitrary. Beside her, in my spanking new outfit, scrubbed and shiny, I feel like a recently hatched chick, untested, and only just learning how to navigate the world. "Yeah, I know who she is," says Paler. "You're alive, then. We weren't sure." Am I wrong, or is there a note of accusation in her voice? "I'm still not sure myself," I answer. "Been in recovery," Boggs taps his head. "Bad concussion." He lowers his voice a moment. "Miscarriage. But she insisted on coming by to see your wounded." "Well, we've got plenty of those," says Paler. "You think this is a good idea?" says Gale, frowning at the hospital. "Assembling your wounded like this?" "I don't. Any sort of contagious disease would spread through this place like wildfire." "I think it's slightly better than leaving them to die," says Paler. "That's not what I meant," Gale tells her. "Well, currently that's my other option. But if you come up with a third and get coin to back it, I'm all ears." Paler waves me toward the door. "Come on in, Mockingjay. And by all means, bring your friends." I glance back at the freak show that is my crew, steel myself, and follow her into the hospital. Some sort of heavy industrial curtain
hangs the length of the building, forming a sizable corridor. Corpses lie side by side, curtain brushing their heads, white cloths concealing their faces.
"We've got a mass grave started a few blocks west of here, but I can't spare the manpower to move them yet," says Paylor.
She finds a slit in the curtain and opens it wide. My fingers wrap around Gale's wrist.
"Do not leave my side," I say under my breath.
"I'm right here," he answers quietly.
I step through the curtain and my senses are assaulted. My first impulse is to cover my nose to block out the stench of soiled linen, putrefying flesh and vomit, all ripening in the heat of the warehouse. They've propped open skylights that crisscross the high metal roof, but any air that manages to get in can't make a dent in the fog below. The thin shafts of sunlight provide the only illumination, and as my eyes adjust, I can make out row upon row of wounded, in cots, on pallets, on the floor, because there are so many to claim the space. The drone of black flies, the moaning of people in pain, and the sobs of their attending loved ones have combined into a wrenching chorus. We have no real hospitals in the districts. We die at home, which at the moment seems a far desirable alternative to what lies in front of me. Then I remember that many of these people probably lost their homes in the bombings. Sweat begins to run down my back, fill my palms. I breathe through my mouth in an attempt to diminish the smell. Black spots swim across my field of vision, and I think there's a really good chance I could faint. But then I catch sight of Paler, who's watching me so closely, waiting to see what I am made of, and if any of them have been right to think they can count on me. So I let go of Gale and force myself to move deeper into the warehouse, to walk into the narrow strip between two rows of beds.
"Katniss!"
a voice croaks out from my left, breaking apart from the general din.
"Katniss!"
A hand reaches for me out of the haze. I cling to it for support. Attached to the hand is a young woman with an injured leg. Blood has seeped through the heavy bandages, which are crawling with flies. Her face reflects her pain, but something else, too, something that seems completely incongruous with her situation.
"Is it really you?"
"Yeah, it's me," I get out. "Joy." That's the expression on her face. At the sound of my voice, it brightens, erases the suffering momentarily.
"You're alive! We didn't know. People said you were, but we didn't know,"
she says excitedly. "I got pretty banged up, but I got better," I say, "just like you will."
"I've got to tell my brother."
The woman struggles to sit up and calls to someone a few beds down.
"Eddie! Eddie! She's here! It's Katniss Everdeen!"
A boy, probably about 12 years old, turns to us. Bandages obscure half of his face. The side of his mouth, I can see, opens as if to utter an exclamation. I go to him, push his damp brown curls back from his forehead, murmur a greeting. He can't speak, but his one good eye fixes on me with such intensity, as if he's trying to memorize every detail of my face. I hear my name rippling through the hot air, spreading out into the hospital.
"Katniss! Katniss Everdeen!"
The sounds of pain and grief begin to recede, to be replaced by words of anticipation. From all sides, voices beckon me. I begin to move, clasping the hands extended to me, touching the sound parts of those unable to move their limbs, saying, "Hello, how are you? Good to meet you." Nothing of importance, no amazing words of inspiration, but it doesn't matter. Boggs is right. It's the sight of me, alive, that is the inspiration. Hungry fingers devour me, wanting to feel my flesh. As a stricken man clutches my face between his hands, I send a silent thank you to Dalton for suggesting I wash off the makeup. How ridiculous! How perverse I would feel presenting that painted capital mask to these people,
the damage, the fatigue, the imperfections. That's how they recognize me, why I belong to them. Despite his controversial interview with Caesar, many ask about Peeta, assure me that they know he was speaking under duress. I do my best to sound positive about our future, but people are truly devastated when they learn I've lost the baby. I want to come clean and tell one weeping woman that it was all a hoax, a move in the game. But to present Peeta as a liar now would not help his image, or mine, or the cause. I begin to fully understand the lengths to which people have gone to protect me. What I mean to the rebels, my ongoing struggle against the capital, which has so often felt like a solitary journey, has not been undertaken alone. I have had thousands upon thousands of people from the districts at my side. I was their mockingjay long before I accepted the role. A new sensation begins to germinate inside me. But it takes until I am standing on a table, waving my final goodbyes to the hoarse chanting of my name to define it. Power. I have a kind of power I never knew I possessed. Snow knew it as soon as I held out those berries. Plutarch knew when he rescued me from the arena. And Coin knows now. So much so that she must publicly remind her people that I am not in control. When we're outside again, I lean against the warehouse, catching my breath, accepting the canteen of water from Boggs.
You did great, he says.
Well, I didn't faint or throw up or run out screaming. Mostly I just rode the wave of emotion rolling through the place.
We got some nice stuff in there, says Cressida.
I look at the insect cameramen, perspiration pouring from under their equipment. Masala scribbling notes. I had forgotten they were even filming me.
I didn't do much, really, I say.
You have to give yourself some credit for what you've done in the past, says Boggs. What I've done in the past? I think of the trail of destruction in my wake. My knees weaken, and I slide down to a sitting position. That's a mixed bag.
Well, you're not perfect by a long shot, but times being what they are, you'll have to do, says Boggs.
Gale squats down beside me, shaking his head.
I can't believe you let all those people touch you. I kept expecting you to make a break for the door.
Shut up, I say with a laugh.
Your mother's going to be very proud when she sees the footage, he says.
My mother won't even notice me. She'll be too appalled by the conditions in there. I turn to Boggs and ask, is it like this in every district?
Yes, most are under attack. We're trying to get in aid wherever we can, but it's not enough.
He stops a minute, distracted by something in his earpiece. I realize I haven't heard Haymitch's voice once, and fiddle with mine, wondering if it's broken.
We're to get to the airship immediately,
Boggs says, lifting me to my feet with one hand.
There's a problem.
What kind of problem? Asks Gale.
Incoming bombers, says Boggs.
He reaches behind my neck and yanks Cinna's helmet up onto my head.
Let's move.
Unsure of what's going on, I take off running along the front of the warehouse, heading for the alley that leads to the airstrip. But I don't sense any immediate threat. The sky's an empty, cloudless blue. The street's clear except for the people hauling the wounded to the hospital. There's no enemy, no alarm. Then the sirens begin to wail. Within seconds, a low-flying V-shaped formation of Capitol hoverplanes appears above us, and the bombs begin to fall. I'm blown off my feet, into the front wall of the warehouse. There's a searing pain just above the back of my right knee. Something has struck my back as well, but it doesn't seem to have penetrated my vest. I try to get up, but Boggs pushes me back down, shielding my body with his own. The ground ripples under me as bomb after bomb drops from the planes and detonates. It's a horrifying sensation being pinned against the wall as the bombs rain down. What was that expression my father used for easy kills? Like shooting fish in a barrel. We are the fish, the street the barrel.
Katniss!
I'm startled by Haymitch's voice in my ear.
What?
Yes, what? I'm here, I answer. Listen to me. We can't land during the bombing, but it's imperative you're not spotted, he says.
So they don't know I'm here?
I assumed, as usual, it was my presence that brought on punishment. Intelligence thinks no, that this raid was already scheduled, says Haymitch. Now Plutarch's voice comes up, calm but forceful, the voice of a head game maker used to calling the shots under pressure. There's a light blue warehouse 3 down from you. It has a bunker in the far north corner. Can you get there? We'll do our best, says Boggs. Plutarch must be in everyone's ear because my bodyguards and crew are getting up. My eye instinctively searches for Gale and sees he's on his feet, apparently unharmed.
You've got maybe 45 seconds to the next wave, says Plutarch.
I give a grunt of pain as my right leg takes the weight of my body, but I keep moving. No time to examine the injury. Better not to look now, anyway. Fortunately, I have on shoes that Cinna designed. They grip the asphalt on contact and spring free of it on release. I'd be hopeless in that ill-fitting pair that 13 assigned to me. Boggs has the lead, but no one else passes me. Instead, they match my pace, protecting my sides, my back. I force myself into a sprint as the seconds tick away. We pass the second gray warehouse and run along a dirt-brown building. Up ahead, I see a faded blue facade, home of the bunker. We have just reached another alley, need only to cross it to arrive at the door when the next wave of bombs begins. I instinctively dive into the alley and roll toward the blue wall. This time it's Gale, who throws himself over me to provide one more layer of protection from the bombing. It seems to go on longer this time, but we are farther away. I shift onto my side and find myself looking directly into Gale's eyes. For an instant the world recedes, and there is just his flushed face, his pulse visible at his temple, his lips slightly parted as he tries to catch his breath.
You all right?
He asks, his words nearly drowned out by an explosion.
Yeah, I don't think they've seen me, I answer. I mean, they're not following us.
No, they've targeted something else, says Gale.
I know, but there's nothing back there, but...
The realization hits us at the same time.
The hospital.
Instantly, Gale's up and shouting to the others.
They're targeting the hospital. Not your problem, says Plutarch firmly. Get to the bunker.
But there's nothing there but the wounded, I say.
Katniss?
I hear the warning note in Haymitch's voice and know what's coming.
Don't even think about...
I yank the earpiece free and let it hang from its wire. With that distraction gone, I hear another sound, machine gun fire coming from the roof of the dirt-brown warehouse across the alley. Someone is returning fire. Before anyone can stop me, I make a dash for an access ladder and begin to scale it, climbing, one of the things I do best.
Don't stop!
I hear Gale say behind me. Then there's the sound of his boot on someone's face. If it belongs to Boggs, Gale's going to pay for it dearly later on. I make the roof and drag myself onto the tar. I stop long enough to pull Gale up beside me, and then we take off for the row of machine gun nests on the street side of the warehouse. Each looks to be manned by a few rebels. We skid into a nest with a pair of soldiers, hunching down behind the barrier.
Boggs, know you're up here?
To my left, I see Paler behind one of the guns, looking at us quizzically. I try to be evasive without flat-out lying.
He knows where we are, all right.
Paler laughs.
I bet he does. You've been trained in these?
She slaps the stock of her gun.
I have in 13, says Gale, but I'd rather use my own weapons.
Yes, we've got our bows. I hold mine up, then realize how decorative it must seem. It's more deadly than it looks.
It would have to be, says Paler. All right, we expect at least 3 more waves. They have to drop their sight shields before they release the bombs.
That's our chance. Stay low. I position myself to shoot from one knee.
Better start with fire, says Gale.
I nod and pull an arrow from my right sheath. If we miss our targets, these arrows will land somewhere, probably the warehouses across the street. A fire can be put out, but the damage an explosive can do may be irreparable. Suddenly, they appear in the sky, 2 blocks down, maybe 100 yards above us, 7 small bombers in a V formation. Geese! I yell at Gale. He'll know exactly what I mean. During migration season, when we hunt fowl, we've developed a system of dividing the birds so we don't both target the same ones. I get the far side of the V, Gale takes the near, and we alternate shots at the front bird. There's no time for further discussion. I estimate the lead time on the hover planes and let my arrow fly. I catch the inside wing of one, causing it to burst into flames. Gale just misses the point plane. A fire blooms on an empty warehouse roof across from us. He swears under his breath. The hover plane I hit swerves out of formation, but still releases its bombs. It doesn't disappear, though. Neither does one other I assume was hit by gunfire. The damage must prevent the sight shield from reactivating.
Good shot, says Gale.
I wasn't even aiming for that one, I mutter. I'd set my sights on the plane in front of it. They're much faster than we think.
Positions!
Paler shouts. The next wave of hover planes is appearing already.
Fire's no good, Gale says.
I nod, and we both load explosive-tipped arrows. Those warehouses across the way look deserted anyway. As the planes sweep silently in, I make another decision.
I'm standing!
I shout to Gale and rise to my feet. This is the position I get the best accuracy from. I lead earlier and score a direct hit on the point plane, blasting a hole in its belly. Gale blows the tail off a second. It flips and crashes into the street, setting off a series of explosions as its cargo goes off. Without warning, a third V formation unveils. This time, Gale squarely hits the point plane. I take the wing off the second bomber, causing it to spin into the one behind it. Together they collide into the roof on the warehouse across from the hospital. A fourth goes down from gunfire.
All right, that's it,
Paler says. Flames and heavy black smoke from the wreckage obscure our view.
Did they hit the